Welcome to the CSDW Podcasts. I'm Doug Dangler. Today our guest is creative writer and professor emeritus in the Graduate Fiction Writing Program at the City College of New York, Frederick Tutton. Mr. Tutton received a Guggenheim Fellowship for Creative Writing from the American Academy of Arts and Letters, and he's at OSU for a reading from some of his novels. This is also where his literary archives reside, in the Contemporary American Literature Manuscripts of the OSU Library's Rare Books and Manuscripts Department. Hello.
Good morning. Good morning, Doug.
How are you today?
I'm very well. Just to say that the Guggenheim is a Guggenheim Fellowship given by the Guggenheim Foundation. And the other award was the award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters.
Okay.
For distinguished writing. So they're really sort of separated.
Well, I'd like to ask you a couple questions about some of your books. Your book, Tintin in the New World, is a reimagining of the European cartoon character. How did you become interested in the Tintin character?
Well, it's, people in Europe all know about Tintin or Tintin. They grow up with him. But Americans of my generation really didn't. We didn't know much about him. The books weren't to be found here. It was very hard to find them at all in English. The translations. But I happened upon them because two British boys, young boys, 9 and 10, one summer when they stopped beating each other to a pulp, they stopped only because they were reading this Tintin book. And I was fascinated to see what they were doing. I looked over their shoulder. I said, if I can look with them, and they let me do it. And I began to read them, and then I borrowed them from their parents, and I was in love. I was just crazy for the character. I thought that was an extraordinary, fresh, wonderful character, and the series themselves were so beautifully drawn, and the adventures were so fresh, and so bizarre that Tintin would have as a sidekick an alcoholic sea captain. I mean, it was very strange things within the conventions of a normative child's, comic book. Very little violence, unlike most American cartoon books, for kids. I mean, there's very little violence, and it's very subtle, and it's witty. And I was just taken by it. I was thinking about the continuity of the stories, everything. And long and short, it was eventually through the intercession of a film director, Alain René, the French director, did last year at Marienbad, who and I were friends. And he brought me to meet Hergé. So I met Hergé, and we became good friends. And because of that friendship, I was able to use the characters' names. Otherwise, it would have been impossible.
I picked up some of the Tintin books yesterday, and I started reading one to my daughter last night, who is 8, and I had to take them away from her later because she wasn't going to bed.
Well, they're wonderful. And, of course, for a kid, they're such endearing things. I mean, Tintin himself is endearing because he's both naive and innocent and good, but he's not entirely just a goody-goody. That's great. And the best, I think, for children of the dog is Milou. In French, it's Milou, and it's Snowy in the English translation because he's unlike most dog heroes. If you read them all, you'll see that he's perverse. And that's sort of interesting. I'll give you one example that enchants me. I think it's Tintin in the Land of Tibet, or Tintin in Tibet, something like that. And they're up in some incredibly high mountain, and Tintin breaks his ankle. Something happens to him, and he's sitting in a little cave, and he says to the dog, go down to the village and get help. And then you see him running and running down the village, and running, scampering, little small trail, mountain trails. And then he comes upon a huge bone. It's like an ox bone. And the panel, he stops, and you can see in the panel is a little devil dog and a little angel dog on either side of him. And the little angel dog says, you have to go down now and rescue Tintin. And the devil says, you'll never see a bone like this again. When you turn the page, he's eating the bone. I mean, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, and he seems to talk in it as well.
I'm not sure if he talks. He talks, but he doesn't talk to Snow. He doesn't talk to Tintin.
Yeah, he just has these thought balloons.
He has a balloon, his thoughts. Yeah, right. You see his thoughts, his balloon thoughts.
Yeah, my daughter and I were debating last night whether he was talking and whether anybody would hear him and things like that.
In my novel, I have when Tintin sort of becomes more than just Tintin, he becomes sort of an extra. He goes to the extra world. He becomes the be able to divine things that most people cannot understand either by hearing or seeing. And that's when he begins to hear Snowy, and they can actually communicate. And Snowy says to him, finally, at last, you're my brother, I can speak to you. I'm touched by it myself.
All right. Well, there are rumors on the internet that Peter Jackson and Steven Spielberg, you may have heard this, will be using performance capture technology to produce a 3D version of it. Are you familiar with the project?
There's a wonderful playwright, if you must know him, is Tony Kushner.
Yes.
Angels in America. And we're friends, I hope. I know we are. But he told me about the project. And in fact, he loved the Tintin novel, and he spoke to Spielberg about me. He said he mentioned it to me, Spielberg, and Spielberg said he knew about me. I think from other times, for other reasons, it's a long story. But I know about the project. I don't know if they're going to do it in cartoon version. I don't know what they're doing. But I would have loved to have been part of it. I would love to have some input into it.
It looks really interesting from it. Well, maybe we could talk about what kinds of intersection between art, graphic novels, and textual novels you find intriguing, because you've set this novel in the world. It's a real world, but obviously based on the graphic novel characters. And I'm wondering if there are other areas that you're interested in, or other things coming down the line that you're finding intriguing.
It's been a sort of fashion of mine to use characters that already existed. The first novel is The Adventures of Mao on the Long March. It's a novel about Mao Zedong's Long March, but it's a very experimental, very radically experimental novel made up of quotations. But I had a ready-made. I had Mao, I had the Long March itself, 1936 to 39, as a spine for the book. So there's that. I had a character, Van Gogh, in Van Gogh's Bad Cafe, the last 3 days before he committed suicide in Auvers-sur-Oise. Tallien, A Brief Romance, is about a young French revolutionary. He really did exist, very little known, but a really interesting young hothead, radical regicide, and I was fascinated by him. So those books, including the Tintin, already had existing life. I mean, there were existences before the book came into existence. There were characters one could read about in history. The last novel was very different. It's very different. I deliberately wanted to make a book born wholly from imagination, and that's called The Green Hour, and it's about a woman who's an art historian, was in love with Poussin, who was one of my big favorite painters, and also Goya. So there's a polarity between a romantic imagination and a classical imagination. It's a love novel. It's a very simply, directly, I hope, well-told story of a brilliant woman in love with a bad guy, like most women are most of the times.
Are there new people coming out or new styles that you find interesting that might combine other elements in maybe similar ways to what you've been working on, sort of art and in Tintin's case, the graphic novels and things like that?
I try to keep current as much as I can, and I like Chabron's books, and I like very much Jonathan Latham. But I don't see exactly this notion we're talking about. I see them writing pretty imaginative and wonderful books, but not in the order where there's borrowings or appropriations or anything like that. I don't see that. I think that's more of an old postmodernist strategy. I don't think too much now. I don't think that's working too much now.
I've noticed in a lot of your stuff that you've got a deep appreciation and interest in art, and I'm wondering how that got started. Is that something that you've just always from childhood been interested in, or is this something that, you know, I guess I got some of the appreciation of art that I've got from going to art appreciation classes, you know, and having it sort of pushed. But how did that function?
Well, as for me, it's very different than that. Would take a long autobiographical voyage. But I grew up in the Bronx in a very, what would they say, economically challenged circumstances, the PC term for it. I was raised in really almost dire poverty. I lived with my mother and my grandmother. My father had left when I was 10 and never supported us. So it was a very difficult time. The world I lived in was the imagination of books. It's all I had. And I read avidly. And for some reason, I was very taken by going to the library and looking at art books, especially the Impressionists. So by the time I was 14 or 15, I was crazy for painting, crazy to look at painting. And I guess, you know, when you're a kid, there's a lot of ways to escape. Some of my friends became like gangsters, I suppose you'd call it. I don't know. I went the other way in some way, some imaginary world, and I wanted to be a painter. I dropped out of high school to become a painter. At a time when most people dropped out of high school were like juvenile delinquents. They were fearful for my life. I'd always become a criminal. But I had this idea that I was going to go to Paris and become... I had seen American in Paris with Gene Kelly. I was 15 and a half, and I thought, that's what you have to do. You go to Paris, and then you'll find a cafe, and they'll find that you're a wonderful young artist, and they'll give you a room free. Then you'll find a beautiful young woman who wants to be your girlfriend because you're a great American artist. I mean, all the fantasies of a kid. But I did leave high school. I did want to paint. I was writing poetry, very pretentious poetry. I know, I guess, combination of Wallace Stevens and Walt Whitman and everyone else under the sun of Melange. But my passion was very much for the visual arts. I loved it. And then I took some pathetic classes at the Art Students League, and my teacher broke my heart. And I was just a kid. I mean, I was just a baby, and I didn't know how to even make a life drawing. I didn't know what to do. I was in a room suddenly with a model and tried to make a life drawing. And a moment, he said to me, Ernst Feeney, his name was, a German refugee artist. He said, what does she have on her, what are those things? I said, those are her feet. Oh, he said very ironically, is she wearing galoshes? And I realized, you know, I didn't have the facility. Let me put it another way. If I had only known better, I never would have been fooled myself into thinking that if you cannot make a representational drawing, you cannot be an artist. That's what I thought. If you can't make a thing look like the thing is in front of you, you have no right to be an artist. Of course, that was a stupid idea, a very stupid and very uninformed idea at a time when, I guess, there wasn't much information about that. There were maverick artists. There were, you know, all the de Koonings and the Pollocks and all those wonderful abstract expressionist paintings. But that wasn't what was going around, you know, in the art school, certainly, at the time.
Your novels, you already mentioned the Adventures of Mao and the Long March and Tintin in the New World, and they feature covers by Roy Lichtenstein,
yes,
a former OSU student.
Yeah.
With Tintin, as we've said, being based on the graphic novels, I'm wondering if you could talk more about sort of the interests that might have led to this. You mentioned the author of Tintin. Are there other backgrounds that you're pulling from? I know that you've got the Magic Mountain and Tintin.
Yeah,
and,
well, to go back to two things again. It's very, very wonderful to be here, come off the airport here, and see Roy Lichtenstein's sculpture in the airport.
Oh, right.
Well, he was my oldest friend and my closest friend. I met him in 1963, 64, and we were very close until he died. He did the covers for those books, for the Mao book and for the Tintin, and a frontispiece for Tintin. He never paid for those things. You know, the publishers were, when they heard that he was going to do the cover, they got frightened. They said, we can't afford that. I said, no, you can't. You can never afford it. But he's doing it because he wants to help the book. I had a very close friendship with him, and I know about his life here. We talked about it very often. He loved Ohio. He loved being here. He studied with Hoyt Sherman. He learned a great deal. He always spoke about Hoyt Sherman. He was married to a woman from Ohio, had children here. And I think what happened eventually is they didn't give him tenure, so he left. And he's always said to me, I could have stayed in Ohio the rest of my life. He said it was just by some chance that I left and then other things happened. The Magic Mountain, the thing is that the Tintin book is, yes, it's about Tintin and Captain Haddock and Snowy, and they go to Machu Picchu, and it's an adventure of the soul, it's an adventure of spirit, it's an adventure of transformation, love being part of it. But I have him meet the characters from the Magic Mountain, Claudia Chauchat, Peeperkorn, Naphtha, and Settembrini. So it's a combination of the New World and the Old World, meeting in the New World and Machu Picchu. People from the Old World debating, arguing, fighting, killing even, for both love and politics. It's a very philosophical, if I may say pretentiously, political novel. I was so enamored, and I still am so enamored with The Magic Mountain. I know for many people it's a hard read. I just think it's a wonderful book, a funny book. I think it's full of wonderful, dry humor, wonderful, and knowing so much about life. Parenthesis, when we spoke about contemporary fiction, not to be a curmudgeon, what I wish I find more of, what I'd like to find more of in contemporary fiction, is wisdom, which I find in certain writers, Dostoevsky, Mann, Celine, lots of people, Melville, time and again, Hawthorne, time and again. Sometimes even in Fitzgerald, not too much in Hemingway, but I long for that. As I get older, I want to read a novel that satisfies me on many levels, not just a good story, not a good character, not a good read, people I'll remember a long time. I want to come out of it feeling something has transformed me. I've learned something. I don't mean that I've learned like how to drive a car or life is real, life is earnest. I don't know. It's inexplicable. It's ineffable. Magic Mountain had it for me. So part of what I wanted to do in that strange book of Tintin and the New World was to really bring them back to life again. I really thought of it that way. I missed them. It's hard and it's funny to say that, but I actually have missed them. When I was writing the book, they came back again. There was Claudia, and there were all those characters, and I was in heaven. I was listening to them to talk to me. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd remember their conversations from the dream I had about them.
What's your writing process? When you sit down to work, do you have the room of your own idea where you're off by yourself, or do you have coffee shops?
I have a nice apartment that I've been in for almost 40 years, and there's a little room I work in. I love it there. I love looking out at the park. I live across from Tompkins Square Park. So I'm very privileged. I could never afford that anymore, impossible. I can probably still not afford it in a few years. But I can see trees in a park that I love very much. I've written about that park in different stories and places. I love working in my apartment. I also love working in cafes. I love that. I love going to a place where there are people around me. I put my computer in. I don't mean Starbucks. I mean little places in the East Village that are still small and containable. And sit down, because then you don't have to get up and make coffee. You order your coffee. You want a sandwich, whatever. There are people around you. If it isn't noisy, if it isn't too noisy and it isn't too much music, blasting music, I've written like 5 or 6 short stories in cafes. There's something nice about it. There's something not isolated, something not alienating about it. It's just being alone too much. It makes you a little stir crazy. So cafes, I think, are great places to be.
I've read that you've filmed the story of your life or parts of your life in a couple of different video projects,
that's interesting. Yeah.
I wish I could pronounce
that. My autobiography, a portable. No, that's not a film about me. What it is this. It's a short story. It was published, I think, in Conjunctions. And it's called My Autobiography, Portable with Commentary. And it's a very short piece. It's sort of quotations. I love taking things from other books. And there are little lines, let's say a question, and then the quotation will answer the question. And in truth, if I were to go through the pages, they're not more than 8 pages, I think. It really is the arc of my life. It is the arc of my life to the moment of my projected death. Someone named Millie Iatru and her companion Morgan made a little film of it. That's on, I guess it's on the you can see it on the internet, I guess, and they sent it around. But it's not a film that was made a direct, documentary or anything like that. Oh, there was something else. There was two boys from the Bronx that some BBC people did, tracing myself and Jerome Charon, my oldest friend in history, because we grew up together when we were 16 in the Bronx. He lives in Paris most of the time. He's a very well-known and very loved novelist, and deservedly so. They made a little film about the two of us going through the back to the places we were raised and the parks we went to and the restaurants we went to as kids when we could do that. So that's about it. I don't think there's much else, though.
So do you go back very often? Was that the only time?
I don't go back. We were laughing, Jerry and I. We went back, the crew, we took about 4 days, maybe a little bit more to do the shoot. We saw a woman on the corner who was the wife of the doctor of the location and who had been very kind to me. She was very old. Very, very old, and I was heartbroken to see her. You know, she was so beautiful. Another friend that I grew up with, still living there. I needed to recuperate from that trip. I think I was in bed for a week after that. It moved me so much, and it upset me so much, and brought back so many memories.
Well, we'll move on then, so we don't.
No, am I weeping?
No. the thing I was curious about with the autobiographical pieces, and I guess I had misunderstood the von function of it, but I was wondering about how those experiences were different from writing more true to life autobiographical
pieces. I'll
answer
you to say this. I've written a lot of stories they call self-portraits. Mm-hmm. One self-portrait with cheese. One coming out in Conjunctions this spring is called Self-Portrait with Sicily. One is Self-Portrait with Icebergs. They are stories. They're not memoir. They're stories. But I hope that within that story, some aspect of myself is illuminated, but not in any literal way, not any way that I was born here. They're not. They're very, very, very different from all of that. However, I am writing a memoir. Funny you should ask. I am writing a memoir now, which is very different, very different. And it's not a memoir that's lauded with... it's not a memoir it's not an invention, let's put it that way. Insofar as any memoir always is colored by some fiction. How you tell a story, whatever story, is going to be from your point of view. It's fictional in a way. It's imaginative in some way. But that's what I'm doing now. That's the big challenge for me, this memoir. And it's what we're talking about. It's growing up in the Bronx. It's becoming a painter, wanting to be a painter, becoming a writer. And writing books and traveling and meeting interesting people like Hemingway, like Paul Bowles, like being a friend of Roy Lichtenstein. It's a lot of those people in my life. It's not name dropping. It's just that when you live in New York City, at a certain moment in history, you just meet everyone. I mean, you'd have to really be living in a cave if you didn't, especially in the 60s. In the 60s, all of us knew, all of us, that sounds so pretentious, but poets and writers and artists all knew each other. all entertained with each other, or went out with each other, or went to movies together, or went to dances together. It's dizzying. I wish someone would write about that. But Susan Sontag and Jasper Johns and Klaus Oldenburg and poets, John Ashbery, we all knew each other. We all live in a small, basically contained location of the East and West Village. So the memoir is about lots of those people. I finished a big section on Paul Bowles. I taught with Paul Bowles for 2 summers in Tangier. I did a piece I finished on Hemingway, my crash visit to him in Havana, all that stuff. So that's very different. That's where I am telling me. I guess that's what I'm saying. Me and what these people around me, what they meant to me, what they did to affect my life, how I felt about them, what I thought about their power as humans and their generosity in case of Roy Lichtenstein, because he was amazingly kind man, amazingly kind. So that's what that is about. That's a little different from the fiction, very different.
Following up on that about the community of writers, do you feel like there's a community of writers and intellectuals like what you were describing in the 60s now, still in New York? Is it a different?
It's different. I think it's 2 reasons. I think, first of all, because of the economics of Manhattan, when the younger people are no longer living in Manhattan. The young artists, writers, they live in Brooklyn, even though that's getting very expensive for them, very expensive. And I don't even think they go further and further out in Brooklyn, the further reaches of Brooklyn. So in the beginning, it's like 15 minutes from the center of the city, then it's 20, then it's now, it's 2 hours, it's sad. So there's a dispersal. Of course, at my age, I don't know, except with the students I teach, both at the City College and at the New School, I don't know what groupings have formed. I do know that there are young writers living in Brooklyn who all know each other. I know that, I'm sure, that Paul Auster is a friend of Jonathan Latham. I'm sure that there's a world in Brooklyn, especially in Brooklyn. There's a lot of readings in Brooklyn. Brooklyn writers are reading there. I have a feeling there's a community. I'm in touch a little bit with it. But I'm not sure it interconnects with the art world, for example, as it did in my time. I'm not sure.
What advice do you have for aspiring creative writers? What's the final go away, maybe out of one of your classes? What do you suggest for them now? And do you feel that that's changed in the last several years or 30 years or however long? It seems to be a more difficult economic time to be a writer, perhaps, than it was before.
Oh, well, that's 2 questions. First, what would I give as advice to a young person or old person, whatever person who wants to be a writer? Who hasn't actually fundamentally finished, let's say, any body of work, a collection of stories, a novel, someone in the process. And my advice is that you read everything all the time, that you read everything. Read day and night. And immerse yourself. Have a total immersion of reading. That's the most important thing. And when you read, don't read just to get the point of the piece. Read as a writer reads. Read sentence by sentence. If you love a sentence, copy it down. If you love a paragraph, copy it. If you love it a lot, copy it many times. Feel the rhythm of the sentence. See why the words are there and when that place in that order. Learn something from the reading, much more than any creative writing class will ever give you. Much more. Much more. And I think that there's another piece of advice, which is not to expect anything. That sounds pessimistic, but I mean not to expect anything in the sense that it's a path that leads you fundamentally and finally to your own self-satisfaction and to your joy if you're happy at it. It's not a path that necessarily leads you to rewards with money or success or fame. It doesn't necessarily bring you those things. There are many interesting writers, wonderful writers. They publish. They're not famous. They're not household names. They teach maybe because they can't make a living. They find other ways to make a living. But they're really wonderful writers. And if that's the case for you, you have to know that the joy of the work is what matters. It sounds very old-fashioned, but I can tell you, in the long run, you're breaking your heart if you think that your job is to become a famous author. It happens sometimes, lots of times by luck, by the moment, if you're in the drift of things that's in fashion at the moment, maybe. But I wouldn't think that that's the motive for doing it. If you want to make money, go to an institution and learn how to make money. Go get an MBA, find some other ways to make money. Make money. Let money be creativity. I mean, there's lots of creative things in making money. Let that be your creativity. But fiction, read all the time. Study what you're reading carefully. Listen to the sentences. Hear them. Copy them, if you will. And be faithful to the idea that there is a higher goal. I do believe that. And that goal is the perfection of your idea of your writing. Make it the best you can make it, as long as you're alive.
Well, that's great advice. Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you very much, Doug.
And we'll link to your books off of Amazon or the best place that you have them, and we'll go from there.
That's very kind. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.